You're listening to 2012 and Beyond on WSLR Radio in Sarasota, 96.5 FM, and also streaming live at WSLR.org. My guest today is Andrew Bisaggio, and Andrew is the American lawyer, writer, scholar, and 21st century visionary who served in Project Pegasus at the dawn of the time-space age. And he is also a lawyer in private practice in Washington State and the founder and president of the Mars Anomaly Research Society. His paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, has really opened up some new channels and thoughts on what may possibly be going on in the solar system and on other planets around us. So, Andy, hello, and thanks for being on the phone with me.
Hi, Emily. It's good to be with you today.
Andy, we're going to really be focusing on a project that you were involved with at the beginning of the 70s in 1971. But to start off with, I'd like if we could just talk a bit about yourself and your experiences when you were very young with Project Pegasus and what exactly that was.
Right. Project Pegasus was a classified research and development project within the defense technical community of the United States. It was launched under the aegis of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the agency that brought us the Internet. But before DARPA brought us the Internet, it brought the permanent secret government in the United States quantum access capability. The thrust of the secret research and development program was essentially remote sensing in time. That is to say that it was a technical project that would further the intelligence gathering capability of the United States government to inform the president and other executive branch officials and the United States military leadership of past and future events occurring non-locally in the time-space continuum. And so the project was had under development by 1970 a set of methodologies and technologies to achieve quantum access. And by that I mean the capability to gather information from a non-local distant event in what we might describe as the quantum plenum. Conventionally, this would be regarded as time travel. And so a number of the time travel methodologies that were being derived and they were beginning to research the impact of the technologies on American civilians, including children, which explains my involvement in the project, ran the gamut of everything from conventional remote viewing, which I guess you would view as a form of psychic time travel in real time. They were also working with a device called the Montauk Chair, which is a magnetic transducer that affects human consciousness and allows for a form of technically assisted psychic time travel by boosting a person's mind forward in time and allow them to pre-experience a moment in their own subjective future and then be interviewed about what they saw or pre-experiencing an episode in their own future. And they didn't know at the time whether that was the result of people's life experience being in their brain before it was perceived or being in time waves around them. But they did know that when they placed a person in this chair and place them in this condition of magnetic transduction, they would have an astral projection forward physically in their own consciousness that would cause them essentially to collide with a moment in their own future and live it as they were experiencing it in real time, or as they would experience in the future, real time.
Is that something that you experienced yourself, the Montauk Chair?
Oh, absolutely. I went on when they first, well, Dr. David Anderson of the Time Travel Research Institute has reported quite correctly, and I can corroborate his statement publicly, that beginning in the spring of 1970, the U.S. government placed thousands of American schoolchildren in the Montauk Chair, using them as essentially the psychic interface between the chair and their own subjective futures. And then, so after you came back from that astral projection and you found yourself sitting in the chair, there would be a nice lady from DARPA there who would then debrief you or, you know, question you about what you saw when you were having a pre-experience of, let's say, a 15 to 20 minute episode in your own future. And At that time, I was living in New Jersey. You know, at the time I was in Pegasus, I was growing up in New Jersey. I only had one relative west of Philadelphia, which was my Uncle Ed was living in Santa Barbara, California. And I had no lawyers in the family. And one of the things that occurred when we were walking back from the room where the Montauk chairs were back to the learning lab that I'd been placed in is one of the other children in the project asked me, well, who were you this time? In other words, what did you see on this particular journey that we took this afternoon in the Montauk chair? And I said, I was a lawyer in Seattle. And that, in fact, is what I've become. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Washington State. I haven't yet moved up to Seattle. MARS, the Mars Anomaly Research Society that I founded, is based there. But I actually live and practice law primarily in Southwest Washington, across the Columbia River from Portland, Oregon. Nonetheless, as an 8-year-old in Project Pegasus, I had these visions of my future subjective experiences as an attorney in the state of Washington, actually pre-experienced them. And so when you would come back from one of those astral projections, then you might be asked questions like, well, was the television set on? Oh, well, tell us what was on the TV set. Oh, the President of the United States was giving a speech? What was his name? And so forth. So by boosting the psychic time traveler to their own subjective future, they were then able to work laterally and try to gather more information about what the experiencer saw of their own subjective future. Hence, they were trying to map the future using that methodology.
Okay, I just have a couple of questions on that. One would be, why were they using children? And also, was it frightening at the time to be going through that as a child?
I certainly had no fear in the Montauk chair. I'm going to describe for you today far more advanced time travel technologies that permitted quantum access of a far more threatening nature, in fact, a personally endangering nature. They were using children because essentially the provenance of this historically is that in the late 1950s, Admiral Hyman Rickover was concerned that the American school system was not producing plebes, that is to say, first-year undergraduates at the Naval Academy at Annapolis, that he had confidence he could train to become nuclear submarine captains in the atomic age. And so he launched a federal project called Project Talent that began to screen American school children for advanced intellectual ability, advanced psychic ability, leadership potential, advanced athletic ability, and other human factors so that these children could be provided specialized education so that ultimately, as their lives unfolded, they could be, recruited into the military through the military academies and receive further training to play specialized roles in the more complex and sophisticated post-war society that was emerging after World War II. So that was the overarching reason they were using children. The more specific reason that they were using children in the project that I was in, there were really five reasons. One was that, as I was going to describe, there were more sophisticated forms of quantum access technologies under development. One of them was the teleportation device that derived from the papers of Nikola Tesla that he left at his death in 1943. And those had been seized by two War Department officials and forwarded to the world's leading physicists that were then gathering at Los Alamos, New Mexico, to build the atomic bomb. And the United States discovered what one of the devices in Tesla's papers did that afforded basically a teleportation capability by opening up vortal tunnels in the time-space continuum. And because teleportation emerged in 1967-68, by the time I was officially placed in the project, in Project Pegasus in the fall of 1969, they had already begun testing the cognitive and physiological effects of teleportation on civilians, including children. And so that was the first reason why, as a child, I was involved in essentially a dangerous experimental set of defense research and development activities. A second reason is because one of the other, the second major advanced quantum access technology that they were working with was a device that propagated a hologram that was so dense that it had a lensing effect on events occurring non-locally in the quantum hologram. And these events were brought into the laboratory as essentially a light phenomenon, as a spectral array. These devices were called chronovisors, and they derived from an accidental discovery that was made by two Vatican scientists named Ernetti and Gemelli, working at the Catholic University of Milan in the 1940s, who partnered with the distinguished Italian physicist Enrico Fermi, and by the early 1950s had modeled a way to render holograms in which you could see past events going on. And so by the time I found myself in the project in the late 60s, these holograms that were being propagated by the chronovisors were actually cubical fields of light, so that if you were standing away from this cubical hologram, you could look in and see a form of sort of time travel cinema going on. You could see a past or future event occurring as a light array within this cube of light. If, however, you were on the stage of this device when the hologram was turned on and enveloped you, you experienced a form of virtual time travel where you were in that past event as a spectral presence. In other words, you could see and be seen by the creatures or human beings or creatures of that time, but we couldn't be harmed by what was going on in the sense of, let's say, being attacked by somebody in that time, because we were only there, for example, in the way that ghosts are present in on our timeline or in our dimension.
So you weren't in a physical, tangible body, in other words.
Yes, we were in our bodies, and yet this past event was lensed into the laboratory, and so we experienced being in that past or future time as a form of a virtual reality, as a holographic emission that we were immersed in that allowed us to experience that non-local event in a virtual sense. And one of the reasons, the second reason that children were involved in Project Pegasus, as we were told during our training, or as I later learned in discussions I had with my late father, Raymond F. Bishago, who was one of the principal project engineers. He was a senior projects engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company, who was essentially the technical liaison between Parsons and the Central Intelligence Agency in the development of teleportation. But regarding the chronovision experiences, they needed small cooperative human beings, because when they would place an adult chrononaut or time traveler in one of these holographic emissions, the holograms were very sensitive when they first started working with this device, and a large human being would cause the hologram basically to start quaking and go on the blink, just like an early television set. So they explained to us how they needed to train children to be able to put a human being in the hologram and interact with that time and place so that they could later report back what they experienced and what they saw, who they interacted with, and really this virtual time travel experience that they had within the chronovisor. The third reason was, in that context, children were regarded as being more keen percipients of what they were seeing in the holograms, whether they were looking at the hologram from afar or whether they were in the hologram relating with that reality in the past or future. They knew that children are tabula rasa. They don't know what they know, and therefore they see what they're looking at with greater accuracy. Also along those lines, they informed us that these experiences that we were having in time travel, both the conventional remote viewing, that is to say psychic time travel, the technically assisted psychic time travel in the Montauk chair to episodes in their own future, the virtual time travel in the chronovisors, as well as the most dangerous and far-reaching experiences that we had, which was actual physical time travel to past and future events via these Tesla energetic arrays or teleporters, and also a Stargate device that was assembled in our time in concert with staff members who were in the far future. They were essentially training us to be the chrononauts of the next generation. They explained how, just as there was a space exploration program under NASA, there would be a fully fledged time-space exploration program under DARPA. That would be, rather than being a public program, would remain secret. And in the same way that there were individuals who were being trained to be space explorers, and that is to say astronauts, in projects Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, we would be the time-space explorers or chrononauts that would receive additional specialized training and have adult experiences as the nation's chrononauts. And so we were clearly being groomed for adult service in Project Pegasus, which was sort of a secret twin of Project Mercury. In fact, I was present at a discussion at a bar in Albuquerque when I was on the project between my late father and the defense attaché to the project, which was a man who was destined for a fairly illustrious career in government, and that was Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. He was the point man between the Pentagon and individuals like my father, who were the project engineers on Project Pegasus. And he was explaining to my father how when we were in high school, we would be recruited into the Naval Academy, and that would be used as the context to involve us in additional secret activities as the nation's chrononauts. And so that was their plan for our lives. We would be essentially adult time-space explorers in a secret Navy program that would continue to extend its ambit, essentially mapping the past and future and carrying out special missions where we retrieved information, for example, from the future, which was a limited set of activities that I was actually involved in myself while I was still a child on the project. And so they were using children for all of those reasons, and it was actually in the several years prior to my father's death in 1990, we had a number of heart-to-hearts about what I had experienced in the project and what we had experienced together. We had really a high adventure, you know, as a father and son caught up in the early days of time-space exploration by the U.S. government. But we always had this one-off kind of secret relationship about what we had done together because, quite frankly, my mother and my siblings and the other kids in the neighborhood and so forth really didn't have a need to know about what the U.S. government was doing secretly in the area of quantum access. And so most of the discussions I had when I was on the project about the project were, you know, one-off heart-to-heart discussions with my dad. And he gave me a fifth reason as to why they were working with children in such a dangerous and experimental and truly emergent area of high technology. And that is because when they were using adults, for example, Navy enlisted personnel, in time travel, the deracinating effects of being moved back and forth between timelines was frequently causing adult time travelers to basically to become insane. And so they wanted to bring children along slowly and acclimate them to time-space exploration and its sort of disquieting psychological effects while we were still children. You know, just as if, for example, you trained a child to scuba dive, at a certain age, they're hopping between the terrestrial and the aquatic environments, you know, like amphibious animals. They're so comfortable scuba diving. I think it was in that spirit that they decided that they would, you know, basically survey the U.S. population of children for children of high intelligence, high psychic ability, and who were perceptive, who had, you know, type B sort of cooperative personalities that would comply with the secrecy and ask what we were asked to do in the program, and essentially bring us along as America's next generation, or really first generation of chrononauts. And so, you know, that was the fifth reason. My dad explained basically we were being psychologically prepared for very substantial activities in time travel in adulthood because they thought that we would be more psychologically grounded when we were asked to do so as grownups.
What you described somewhat reminds me of things I've heard about the Manhattan Project, in which, if it's true, they used adults with not such great results. Is that something you see as being a similar, more advanced version of it? Or Pegasus a more advanced version of the Manhattan?
Yes, I mean, I think there are really very significant historical linkages between the Manhattan Project and Project Pegasus. One of them being the fact that, you know, Nikola Tesla's papers were never lost. They were forwarded to the very physicists who built the atomic bomb. There was also an overlap just situationally between a number of key project personnel and the Manhattan Project. Let me just cite one, and then I can describe several of my encounters on the project with some of the other very illustrious physicists who were attached to the Manhattan Project. The Federal Science Administrator for Project Pegasus was Dr. Harold M. Agnew. My father and I, well, at least I first encountered Dr. Agnew in 1967-68 when I first teleported from the teleport at the old Curtiss Wright Aeronautical Company facility at 1 Passaic Avenue in Woodridge, New Jersey. We jumped through a Tesla device there and then popped back, traveled through a vortal tunnel in the time-space continuum, and then popped into view at the old, near the old state capitol building in the state capitol complex in Santa Fe, New Mexico. That was being used as sort of the collection area for teleportees into New Mexico during this whole era. For me, between the first time I teleported there in 1957-68 time frame, and then ultimately the summer of 1972, about 5 years later. We went over to the Los Alamos National Labs, and my dad presented the prospectus to involve civilians, including American school children, in teleportation experiments to Dr. Agden when he was the director of the W division, the weapons division of the lab. And that's the true history, unfortunately, of U.S. time travel technical development. Time travel was sequestered within the military industrial intelligence complex at its inception as a result of Tesla's papers being forwarded to Los Alamos. And that's one of the reasons I'm speaking out, is because, for example, the great benefit, you know, the life advantage and benefit that teleportation could be to humanity as perhaps a civilian transportation modality that would replace, like, for example, long-distance air travel, has not emerged in the public realm because it was made secret in 1943. And so we met with Agnew. He was the Federal Science Administrator. In that meeting, he was reviewing the prospectus that my dad had drafted and doing things like scrutinizing the budget for the project. I know that that meeting occurred between 1967 and 68 because during that meeting, he asked my father how old I was, and my father and I answered simultaneously, six. And because I was born in September of 1961, that meeting hence had to have occurred between September of 1967 and 68. There was also a very fascinating discussion between my father and Dr. Agnew at that meeting in which he said, how was your trip, you know, to New Mexico from the East Coast? And my dad said, fast. He said fine and fast. And Dr. Agnew looked up from the prospectus with a sort of an insider's grin on his face and said, oh, did you take the teleport? And my dad said, yes, and so did my number three son, Andy. And then my dad paused for a few seconds and then said to Dr. Agnew, have you tried it yet? And Dr. Agnew said, no, but I want to. And to me, I think we can infer that seems to suggest that teleportation as a practical capability had then only recently emerged in the defense technical community, because clearly a scientist, indeed a Manhattan Project scientist as connected as Dr. Agnew, would have already tried it if it had emerged much earlier than then. So what do I mean when I say Dr. Agnew was so well connected? Well, he was the only human being who was a participant in all three critical stages of the Manhattan Project. He was an assistant to Enrico Fermi. There's the Fermi connection again. At CP1, which is when the atomic pile went critical, at the squash courts at the University of Chicago, where Agnew was Dr. Fermi's prized pupil, prized protege in physics at the University of Chicago. Agnew was also present at Los Alamos and Alamogordo when the atomic bomb was manufactured and tested. And then he was also present in the Great Artiste, which was the chase plane that followed the Enola Gay at the time that it dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And so he had a significant role in the Manhattan Project. But here, 25 years after the dropping of the atomic bomb, my father and I meet him, and it's all about teleportation, chronovision, and other secret technologies that would allow the U.S. intelligence community to gather information from distant events in the past and the future, which would give it really an unprecedented strategic advantage vis-a-vis the two forces in the universe that they were concerned about, namely the Greys and the Reds, which is to say, whoever the extraterrestrials were and what they intended, because they knew we were being visited by different extraterrestrial civilizations, and also the former Soviet Union. They were concerned about a Soviet push for world dominance that might even include a land invasion of the lower 48 of the United States. So Dr. Agnew was one of the principals on Project Pegasus. He had this conspicuous connection to Fermi, and Fermi's fingerprints, hence, are on both the chronovisor capability as the mentor of Ernetti and Gemelli and the derivation of the chronovisors, and he also has a linkage to Agnew and the derivation of teleportation, and its reduction to practice because he was essentially Harold Agnew's mentor in nuclear physics. I met several other of the Manhattan Project physicists during my service. One, of course, was Dr. Edward Teller, who was present trying to fix one of the chronovisor arrays during one of the summers that I was in New Mexico on the project. And I also was present standing next to my dad in the hallway at the Los Alamos National Labs when he informed the atomic physicist, Dr. Emilio Segre, who was also attached to the Manhattan Project, that we were there at Los Alamos and Sandia on a teleportation project. And Dr. Segre was quite gracious and said that it was fascinating to learn that such a classified research project was underway, and asked my father to keep him apprised of what was accomplished in Project Pegasus. So it's critical for your listeners to know that time travel not only emerged by 1967-68 and was kept secret 40 years ago, but the complication historically is that it was deeply embedded in the weapons division of the atomic labs in New Mexico. And that's the reason why all of these different cover stories about time travel have been propagated over the years as disinformational ploys to conceal Project Pegasus and its quantum access capability, and really confuse the world public about this subject and really prevent these secrets from escaping the defense labs. But unfortunately, the cat is now out of the bag. You know, Schrodinger's cat is now out of the bag, because I am not going to give up and I'm not going to give in. I'm going to continue to lecture and speak and reveal what I know about Project Pegasus, because I believe that this teleportation capability that it derived 40 years ago may not just be beneficial, but may be necessary for our planetary survival. So I'm speaking out now, and I will continue to do so. But that's really the historical context in which U.S. time travel emerged. It was really the hidden stepchild of the Manhattan Project.
Andy, I know specifically you wanted to talk a bit about the time probe to 2013, but I just have a couple of questions I want to ask you on the Pegasus project. Is this technology and information that sounds phenomenally advanced? Do you know if other world governments have it, or is it something that only the United States particularly has?
Well, you know, that's a difficult question. I frequently ask that. I can say that In the one-off discussions I had with my dad, just being his son and also being in this secret defense project with him, I mean, we had many discussions. I was a very querulous child. I was one of those kids who asks, you know, 50 questions a day of their mom and dad. And I had many discussions with my dad about where the technology was. I do know that clearly we were ahead of the former Soviet Union, but that we were really racing to beat them to these technologies. In fact, the technologies themselves were being used, for example, the teleport was being used to teleport the plans to our most sensitive weapon systems, not just to New Mexico, where they could be stored underground, but to New Mexico several years in the future. Because during one teleporting that my dad and I took from Curtis Wright in mid-November of 1971, which is right after the event that I'm going to describe for you today on today's show, he was given military plans at Curtis Wright. There was a military officer there who handed him a mailing tube. And when I said, "Dad, what's in the tube?" He said, "Plans to some of our most sensitive weapon systems." And I said, "What do you mean by weapon systems?" He said, "Schematics to our intercontinental ballistic missile systems." And so he was actually teleporting that into the future, because when we arrived in New Mexico, in Santa Fe there, and then we dropped off the plans at the Los Alamos National Labs and then drove down to Albuquerque to have lunch at the restaurant of an old friend of his there, he had promised that he would be returning to New Mexico in a timely way, and he had me come over to her table and tell them what year it was. And I said, "It's 1971, right?" But it wasn't. It was actually June of 1973. So I believe the people of the United States and also the people of the world need to know the true history of the 20th century, which is that one of the reasons that the United States won the Cold War vis-a-vis the Soviet Union is because it mastered these methodologies, these technologies that allowed for time travel before the Soviet Union did, and we were using it to hide our secrets non-locally. I do know that we were certainly in a competition with the former Soviet Union to achieve mastery of the quantum field, the quantum environment. And I have learned from third parties that there was certainly a teleportation project underway in the former Soviet Union contemporaneous with Project Pegasus of the United States government. I don't know at this point whether other major world powers have achieved either teleportation or quantum vision, but 41 years have now passed since the United States achieved teleportation, so presumably some of the other major world powers either have achieved some of these advanced quantum access capabilities or will soon achieve them.
Now, Andy, we're talking about almost 40 years ago that the technology was that advanced. Are you still involved with this or in contact, or do these people still contact or monitor you? And do you have any concept or idea of how advanced it may have become now 40 years later?
I do. And this is part of my account, and it's difficult to try to explain. But, I mean, you know, I was a child participant in a secret project, so I received specialized training in that context. I was also receiving briefings of aspects of my own destiny because they had determined as early as around the time I began teleporting back and forth between New Jersey and New Mexico that I was destined to play an historically significant role regarding the discovery of life on Mars and the societal acceptance or understanding of that fact. And so, for example, I won't narrate that the whole aspect of that part of my story, but for example, in 1971, I was permitted to read my paper that I would write in 2008 entitled The Discovery of Life on Mars, which is the first written work to prove through clear, convincing, and cogent evidence that Mars is an inhabited planet. And so I was being handled in a special way, not only as a gifted and talented kid in the learning lab that they were using us to groom us for Project Pegasus, and receiving also the specialized training relative to the different forms of quantum access that were underway in Project Pegasus. But I was also being given information, for example, through my father, about aspects of my own personal destiny, not just regarding Mars, but regarding other things. Now, in the intervening years, the government wasn't working with me. I mean, I wasn't a government employee, but periodically I had instances of either having my life disrupted by government operatives or infiltrated by government operatives, or where I was directly given information or guidance by government operatives. And by that I mean either, for example, Navy personnel or CIA personnel, where they were linking back to try to see where I was at psychologically, or they were trying to gather information about what I had done in the project, or they were trying to disrupt my activities and my development as a person, or even discredit me. So,
why was that? Because they didn't want you to reveal what had happened?
Yes, because, for example, Project Pegasus was highly compartmentalized. So, in 1981, the entire CIA didn't understand exactly what Project Pegasus had achieved, and I had a set of experiences that were clearly directed at me by CIA, in which CIA was trying to gather information about what happened in the project. We have to remember that all this stuff goes on in a highly compartmentalized context where you are literally trained at fear of your own survival not to share the information with others who do not have a need to know. I mean, you're talking about training people in a way where they're literally afraid of being assassinated if they breach the security oath that they've been placed under. And this was a real fear. They had made examples of entire families of adult participants in these kinds of projects who had let slip what was going on. I mean things like home invasion robberies where they might assassinate an entire family. These are the kinds of things that people who agree to serve in such projects knew might befall them or their loved ones if they spoke out about what was going on. Okay. So I ended up having a fairly conventional normal life as a kid and a young adult, but I was having periodic strange experiences where I was being intimidated or I was being interviewed about what I remembered we had done in the project. Or I had some strange event in my life where I was being defamed or undermined personally and so forth. And there were actually literally direct interviews that I was sometimes pulled into where there might be some teachers there or a teacher and a Navy officer or somebody from the government. And this kind of secret monitoring of me over longitudinally kind of fomented in 1981 where they actually gave me a contact officer who was a career CIA officer named Courtney M. Hunt, He was an Orange County, California-born cousin of the Hunt dynasty of Texas, the Texas oilmen, for whom the patriarch was Haroldson Lafayette Hunt. And so hence, Courtney descended really from one of the founder families of the United States. And he became, I wouldn't say a mentor, that would sort of glorify the role that he played in my life, but he essentially was my conduit to the CIA, and he was both gathering information about me, and in the summer of 1981, he gave me additional training in teleportation, and I went on two teleportations to Mars, first by myself, and then a second time in the summer of 1981 with Mr. Hunt. And so ultimately, because I had served in Project Pegasus and was familiar with teleportation, and also the bizarre disjunctive experiences of being immersed in past and future events in the chronovisor, I was tapped in 1981 to go up to Mars and really just become acclimated to what was on the surface of Mars. I don't know why I was asked to go up there. I certainly didn't perform any function up there besides going up there. But when I tried to suggest to Courtney, it really wasn't my cup of tea. I really didn't want to go off planet like that. He said, you have to. And when I said, why, he said, because the survival of the human race on Earth depends on it. And again, he never really explained his remark, but I said, well, if it's that serious, I'll go. And so in July and then again in August of 1981, Courtney took me down to a CIA facility in El Segundo, California, and I basically teleported to Mars in one of the jump rooms that have been described in other experiencers' accounts. I can affirm that the jump rooms exist and that they're very elevator-like, and that we have a technology to literally reach the planet Mars, and we've been sending teleportees there for 30 years. And then, again, that's another reason I'm speaking out, is because there have been allegations of a secret space program, and I'm confirming that, yes, indeed, a secret space program does exist, and it has already placed chrononauts on Mars.
Now, when you say that, are you, again, describing going there literally in a physical body or more as an astral projection?
No, that was physical time travel. That was virtually identical to the jumps that I was doing as a kid 10 years earlier through the Tesla device at Curtis Wright, and also the Stargate, the device that we used to access the year 2045, that was located on the gymnasium floor of the Cerritos Cultural Center in Cerritos, New Mexico, outside of Santa Fe. The difference being that this form of teleportation was accomplished with the enveloping environment of an elevator-like device around you. Now, how they pushed that through a vortal tunnel in time-space, I have no idea, because we certainly weren't shrouded by anything like that when I was teleporting as a child in the program. But I do believe I was asked to go up there because I had this background as one of the 140 American schoolchildren who had served in Project Pegasus. In fact, I was the captain of one of the regiments, so to speak, within Project Pegasus. There were 140 American school children. They were divided into 14 colors consisting of 10 team members, and I was the captain of the blue team. And so I had somewhat of a signal significance in the program, not only as one of the captains of the different divisions they had, the cadre of children divided into, but I survived a lot and jumped through a lot of the hoops and was involved in the most advanced quantum access activity that Project Pegasus then undertook in the early 70s, and I was also my father's son. So I don't know exactly why I was tapped in 1981 to go up there, but it clearly related to my destiny as a discoverer of life on Mars, and also the fact that I was psychologically prepared to go off planet via teleportation. I spent 3 years doing that kind of stuff as a kid.
So, Andy, do you have good recall of that, like what it felt like or what it looked like to be there?
Well, you know, Emily, it's kind of funny. I mean, I've been practicing law for 12 years, but for 10 of those, I've been periodically researching what happened to me on Project Pegasus. I've done three major fact-finding trips to New Mexico that were highly successful. I've isolated counts of 12 insider whistleblower-type informants, 10 of whom are still alive, as far as I know. And I have the whole story. I have 225 passages that I'm going to synthesize into my book that basically are anecdotes of the involving the people, the places, the events, the time travel experiences, both when I was on the project as a child and then the brief experiences I had going up to Mars. I'm in full possession of everything that happened during those two trips to Mars, because, you know, it's difficult to be teleported to an alien planet, you know, a strange planet, and not have it really resonate. It was very strange going up there, I must say, and I really admire that first generation of astronauts who landed on the moon, because it is a very, very deracinating experience to be placed on another celestial body. That in itself is almost overwhelming. But yes, I have complete memories of both of the trips to Mars. I have more fragmentary memories of several trips up there after that, but they're so fragmentary that I really can't discern whether they're dreams that resulted from having actually been up there, or whether they are simply later missions that I'm blocked for some reason. But I'm not a victim of mind control. I tried to explain that they just used brainwashing on us when we were in Pegasus, and basically fear and intimidation and some aversive treatment to basically make us comply with the program and to have us not talk about our experiences. But I am not under any kind of mind control and training. And I've also been very transparent about the different relationships I've had with alphabet agencies like DARPA and the CIA and the U.S. Navy. I mean, they're going to be in my book. I'm going to describe exactly what I've done for the U.S. intelligence community. I am a whistleblower from inside the intelligence community. I've not hid my cards about that at all. You know, I'm not some agent for the intelligence community. I'm a former intelligence community insider who's now blowing the whistle about some of the things that the U.S. government has been up to for the last 40 years.
Andy, I know one of the things you really wanted to talk about was your projection, or time probe, as you called it, to 2013, and how you felt that that had perhaps been, if not misquoted, but misconstrued, perhaps, what you have said about that before. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes, I certainly welcome the opportunity, and I thank you for creating this forum where I can clarify this, because I don't want to be misunderstood or misquoted, because the implications of that are so sensitive to the way that people are thinking about 2012. But the most advanced chronovision experience that I had in Project Pegasus took place on November 5th of 1971. And most of the chronovisor probes were done in an old building that was under historical renovation in Morristown, New Jersey, which is where General Washington wintered in the winters of 1777 and 1781. So Morristown is a very famous colonial era, revolutionary era town. And one of the old buildings there, not from the revolutionary era, but from the 19th century, was undergoing historical renovation. And most of the chronovisor probes that I did in New Jersey were at that auditorium inside that building. And we went to many past events, for example, from the chronovisor at Morristown. We had done one previous probe to a U.S. Civil War battle at a more rudimentary chronovisor that was set up at the General Manufacturing Company facility, which was the map-making subsidiary of Standard Oil in Convent Station, New Jersey. But two boys my age had entered the building with their stingrays, you know, with their bicycles, and that was a threat to operational security. So they moved that chronovisor location to Morristown. And we did most of our probes from Morristown, but there was one probe that took place at ITT Defense Communications in Nutley, New Jersey, which was adjacent to the Defense Logistics Agency. And again, this was all about mapping the past and future. So there were these programmatic linkages to the logistical branch of the U.S. military. And in this particular probe, rather than having a couple technicians in the room, there were 40 or 50 people scrambling around the room. And rather than just standing on the stage in our street clothes, we were dressed in a crystal helmet and this spacesuit-like apparel and boots that had been sputter-coated with titanium to actually physically protect us from the brightness of the crystal array, the light in the ceiling that was going to be emitted, that would be so dense that it would allow for basically the future to be brought into the laboratory, so that we could perceive what was going on inside that hologram. And in this particular probe, they counted down. We were actually chained to a post that was on the stage with a loop around our waist, because they were concerned that we might disappear and be pulled somewhere when this device was turned on. And in fact, we did disappear. My dad was watching, and he became so disturbed when he realized that it looked like the device, when it was turned on, had actually caused us to disintegrate, that as I later learned, he had to go into the next room and compose himself. He thought he had lost his fifth child, you know, his number three son, in the project. But what happened was, when they turned on the light, we found ourselves moving forward at a great rate of speed for about a half hour. And we had been trained up at Curtis Wright that when we reached the limit of that projection into the where the future was forming, we would feel three pulses, and we had been trained to look quickly to the left and right and remember and be able to describe what we had seen. Well, what I saw at the end of that technical remote viewing into the superluminal range where the future was forming was the U.S. Supreme Court building under about 100 feet of brackish water. It was almost as if they sent us through cloud after cloud of neon-colored, multicolored cosmic gas, stardust, as it were, and then we reached this limit point where you could see that it was the Supreme Court building, but it was like diving on a marine, you know, archaeological ruin after Washington, D.C. had been substantially flooded. And then we were brought back. We found ourselves on the stage. The underclothing underneath the suit was just stuck to me, and they actually had to pour my boots out on the stage. And that wasn't because they were inundated with water at the end of the probe. That was my own perspiration from the heat of that particular chronovisor. And I asked where my dad was, and then the team leader explained that he had to go to the next room because she said, "You disappeared, son, and your dad had to spend some quiet time adjusting to that fact." So then I was taken down the hallway and debriefed by a lieutenant commander for the Office of Naval Intelligence, and he said, "Andy, okay, tell me about the target." And I said, "Sir, the target, it was underwater." And he became very consternated. He actually got up and started smoking and pacing around his office. And he said, "How do you know it was underwater?" And I said, "Well, when you put me down near the target, I could see that there was algae on the columns of the building." And then the next week, when we were back in the learning lab at our school, we asked the team leaders who were training us what the building was and what year it was. And they acknowledged that it was the U.S. Supreme Court building in the year 2013. Now, in talking about this technically assisted form of remote viewing that I was involved in that particular probe, there has been the assumption that I'm saying that we have to have a planetary catastrophe in 2012, for example, which is the year, obviously, that everybody's looking to because that's the year that the Mayan calendar ends, and catastrophe has been predicted by some theorists that's what 2012 inevitably has to involve. But I need to make clear that, just to be fair, that during all of the chronovisor probes, not the teleportation transits, but the chronovisor probes in this sort of superluminal realm where alternate futures are possible, we were accessing alternate past and future timelines or dimensions, if you will, in the multiverse. For example, when I was jumping to the past, via the chronovisor array in New Mexico, when I was spending those secret summers in New Mexico with my dad, they were sending me over and over again to Ford's Theater on April 14th, 1865, which was the night that Abraham Lincoln was shot there by John Wilkes Booth, in the timeline that we're in. And they were trying to ascertain who shot President Lincoln. Was it John Wilkes Booth? Was it Colonel Rathbone? Was it Mrs. Lincoln pulling a Derringer out of her purse because she was angry at him? Or was it a third party? You know, was John Wilkes Booth up in the balcony seating there to shoot the president or just to rescue him or even to give him an autograph or get his autograph? So they kept on sending me over and over again in this chronovisor probe to the front of Ford's Theater, and they had me dressed in this sort of fancy society kid sort of clothing, and I was talking my way past the ticket agent saying my folks, you know, my parents are already inside and they presented my ticket. So please let me enter and, you know, rejoin my parents. And then I was basically going into the theater, but then walking up the staircase up to the area behind President Lincoln's booth to try to witness the assassination, which I never ended up doing. In fact, that was a part of a number of probes that I was involved in related to the Civil War period and President Lincoln. And so what I was noticing is every time they sent me to that same day in the life of of the United States and of Abraham Lincoln, my experiences there would change a little bit. You know, the guy at the ticket booth would say something different. I would find something different when I walked up the staircase up to his booth and so forth. So I was present at the meeting at the Sandia National Lab Auditorium, that is to say the Sandia Auditorium in Sandia, when there was a meeting among about 20 attendees from the project, you know, at which there were about 20 or 30 of the project engineers like my dad present, and they shut down time travel to the past because the man who was one of sort of the assistant directors of the project was explaining that every time they sent the same child or another child to the same event in history in the chronovisor, it would change a little bit or even change substantially, indicating that the chronovisors were sending the chrononaut to alternate timelines. And so it was an alternate timeline in 2013 that I was sent to in that chronovisor probe on November 5th of 1971, and hence I don't want to be relied upon to state that inevitably there has to be a disaster of a planetary nature, the nature of a planetary catastrophe in 2012. I'm encouraging people to think of 2012 as something quite the opposite, which would be the year that we finally resolve to create a sustainable civilization on Earth and go about the business of starting to achieve essentially the planetary cultural renaissance we need to survive and thrive in the 21st century. And so I just want to clarify this particular point because I've been misquoted widely about this, for example, by the journal called Russian Scientist, where they've stated that, you know, lawyer who was involved in U.S. time travel research in the early 70s is stating that, you know, 2012 is when, you know, this mass disaster is going to occur on planet Earth. I don't believe that. I don't see that now. And I do know that scenario, which I shared with Project Camelot, that is to say Bill Ryan and Terry Cassidy at Project Camelot are friends of mine, and I discussed how during that particular chronovisor probe, yes, some kind of catastrophe had occurred by 2013. But again, this was one slice of the multiverse. This was one alternate future that the chronovisor was capturing the signal of and amplifying before it happened so that we could perceive it as the virtual time travelers visiting that environment. But I don't believe that there necessarily has to be a global catastrophe of some kind in 2012. And I believe that if we set our intention for the beginning of a utopian period of human history in 2012, when calendars are no longer necessary, or for example, where we're, you know, like the Mayan calendar, for example, or where we begin to implement a global program of teleportation to start removing all those greenhouse gases from the global atmosphere, that 2012 could be literally the most significant and benevolent year in human history if that's what we want it to be. And so I just wanted to set the record straight on your show because I know that you've been doing a lot of really excellent reportage about 2012, and I want to join in that discourse in a way that's true to what happened to me when I was a child participant on Project Pegasus.